Hello, I am Jamie McKinley and you're listening to Just Get a Real Job. Thank you, as always, for tuning into the podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm really, really excited to put out today's episode. It's a really interesting conversation and I very, very much enjoyed recording it. Before I introduce this week's guest, I quickly wanted to mention that I noticed on the download charts the other day that we've had quite a few listens in Portugal recently. We'd always had quite a few global listeners. I'm really, really grateful to anyone overseas that listens to this podcast. It means a lot. But yes, we had quite a good few from Portugal. So I just wanted to give a quick shout out to our newly found listen base in Portugal. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. It's always nice having a variety of people and backgrounds on the show as well. So we'll definitely look into seeing if we can get more guests from other parts of the world. And who knows, maybe even get a wee Portuguese creative on the podcast sometime soon. I've never been to Portugal and it's very high on my list of places to visit as well. So thank you to all our newfound Portuguese listeners. It means a lot. But this week on the podcast, we are joined by poet and theatre maker Henry Madd, who is currently on tour with his show The Land of Lost Content, which was first on at the Edinburgh Fringe in 2022, and he's on tour with that at the moment. There's links to that in the show notes. We get more into it in today's episode, but that's currently touring across the UK. And yeah, no, we recorded this episode a couple of weeks ago on a Monday night at the start of a week, but it was such an interesting way to kick the week off. Really, really interesting conversation. I had one of those chats with Henry that could have easily went on for several more hours. A really, really articulate and smart guy, and yeah, we had some really interesting chats about it. We talked about imposter syndrome, feeling like you sort of were never given a heads up on what the creative industries is actually like and how to be part of it and make a career in it, etc. We spoke about purpose and that struggle that creatives often have with feeling like they are doing something worthwhile in the world. You know, we spoke about lots of other things as well. We spoke about his poetry, spoke about the multifaceted nature of his career as well. A really, really rich and interesting conversation. Also put another link into one of Henry's poems from a few years ago, which I'd recommend you check out. We spoke about that in a bit more depth in today's episode as well. And there's links to Henry's social media as well. But a really, really interesting chat. Loved having Henry on the podcast and I hope you enjoy it as well. So without much further ado, this is episode 133 of Just Get a Real Job with the brilliant Henry Madd. Creative industries are merely mess. Artists lie their goods are torn to shreds. The government will spoil your hopes and dreams by offering a useless retraining scheme. There's such amazing talent, why can't you see that the government has decimated the industry? And now the years of hard work could be thrown away. And people who don't care, well, they will say, just get a real job. How's it going, Henry? Thank you very much for coming on Just Get a Real Job tonight. Very, very excited to speak to you.
Cheers, thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for wanting to speak to me.
I suppose a good place to begin is, I don't know if you just want to introduce yourself for the listeners. So you're obviously a poet and a theatre maker, and you've done lots of other stuff. You've been a writer in residence for a theatre as well. Quite an interesting career. I'm very excited to chat to you tonight.
Cheers, yeah. So my name's Henry Madd. But yeah, as you said, poet and theatre maker, slash doing whatever I can to try and make a career in the arts, kind of like stitching them together. I used to work in a theatre and the person who ran it described, when she would ask about what I did outside of this theatre, she'd ask and I'd explain everything. She called it like a portmanteau career, where you like you put sort of like little facilitator slash actor slash writer slash doing odd bits here and there, running community projects, doing all of that. But yeah, it works for me. I think I get bored if I do anything, if I did like the same thing every day.
Yeah, I think it's so common though, the amount of people, I mean, this is like, we've done over 130 episodes of this podcast now, and like so many people have got like four different things on the go, and they work in this and they do this, and I think it's so common. And I read a quote from you in an interview you did, and I loved it, and I thought it really speaks to this podcast. But you were like, you said that you felt like you had missed out on a meeting that a lot of people working in this industry had been to, and you hadn't got the memo or something. I'm paraphrasing,
yeah,
obviously.
You
said it much more elegantly than that. But I just thought that's so interesting. This podcast is all about trying to demystify this strange industry, and I think there's so many people listening that would be like feeling that. I felt that for a very long time before my career sort of kicked off, and yeah, it's just an interesting thing. So I just wanted to sort of quote that because I thought, I just really liked the way you said it. I thought that's bang on the money.
There's that sort of feeling, but it's weird because lots of people say the same thing, but then it doesn't feel like it because you see other people doing things and you go like, oh, how? Yeah, they might be saying it, but from my perspective, they seem to know what they're doing. And I've said that to them and they go, oh yeah, but you know, you've got this show and you've done this and you've done this. It never feels like whatever you've done is enough, or like as impressive as what someone else has done.
Yeah. And I wonder how high up that goes. I wonder if people who making a proper living and, you know, maybe making quite a good amount of income and feel quite successful in their own, in, you know, part of the industry, I reckon they probably feel that as well.
Do you think so? The more successful you are, the more you might end up feeling like an imposter?
Perhaps, yeah. I think obviously background and things play into it, because it's a very like elitist industry as well. I think if you don't come from money, then it's very difficult. You're a bit like, where the hell do I fit in this whole cog?
And I think that's one of the things that I think like a lot of paid education, like private or public school, really like teaches people is like confidence. Because I know everyone, I went to state school, it's like a really rubbish school. And it's that sort of idea that because you've gone there, like you're not as qualified as someone who's been to like a really fancy school where like, I don't know, like the country's terrible leaders have been like, oh, well, they've all gone to like this fancy school. So this is like, unless you've done that, you're not as worthy of being in these like positions, which of course is like ridiculous.
Yeah, no, completely. And like, you know, there's a reason, you know, Eton has like what, 5 theatres or something insane. Yeah. And like, you know, can't even get like a drama curriculum in a lot of schools across the UK. And it's,
yeah
it's interesting. I think the arts actually help confidence as well, which is in an ironic way, but that yet they're not funded. Oh, we'd already went deep quite early. We're only 2 minutes.
Yeah, jump straight in there.
I love it. Well, just to sort of kick things off as well, I wonder if you sort of take us back to your earliest creative influences. So were you always interested in words? Were you always creating things, or did you sort of feel like you do now, where you're quite like open to lots of different things?
No, I wasn't really that creative, I feel, growing up. Like, I think I said this in another interview as well, where I'm like, I never liked writing growing up. Like, writing was what you do for homework or when you're in detention. Like, you know, you're made to write as a punishment. Like, it wasn't ever seen as like, I never saw it as something I could get some enjoyment from. Until I was in my early 20s, when I started getting into writing poetry, maybe slightly earlier than that, maybe like 1920, when I first started getting something back from it, where like the physical effort of writing down started to like pay back. And I think it's because I found the type of writing that I wanted to do, but I wasn't being made to do it, but was allowed to express myself in a way that I found really fulfilling and was able to say something that I felt I hadn't been able to do before with other little bits of like creative endeavors, which has mainly been bits of acting and stuff.
It's interesting as well, because I feel like that speaks to like the way that we teach a lot of creativeness, and especially like things like English, and we, you know, you have to memorize poems, and you have to, as you say, you have to do punishment exercises and things like that. And you know, it's like treating writing and reading and things is like in a very certain way, whereas like when you do it for the fun of it and you just do it for the process of it, then I feel like that is more creative. So I think that's interesting as well.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of, that's a big part of like the education system that needs to sort of like be changed and improved, to like stop making people see it as either, in all terms, like in all creative fields, either it's something that's like underfunded, it's a DOS, like, oh, you've taken arts, like, or you're doing drama, or you've picked like an easier subject, when these are some of the most like difficult subjects to do well in and to succeed in. And also the idea of anything, doing like creative things like writing, or yeah, made to be like a punishment, or, you know, why aren't you made to do calculations instead of writing lines or something?
Yeah, no, completely. Or even just studying a text in like quite a, I don't know, thought out way almost, that maybe that's the wrong word, but like quite a constructed way, instead of just like, what did you feel about this? Like, how did this make you feel? I don't know. As opposed to like, this is what it means. Because it's not, you know, it's quite subjective as well.
Yeah.
Really interesting. And I suppose the other part, were you like, do you remember watching stuff, reading stuff? Were you into things? Did you have quite a lot of influences as a youngster on like, that maybe in the background?
I mean, I was always into like films. I've always been like a big consumer of media. Like, I loved reading as a kid, and then which I kind of lost as a teenager because I discovered other things, which is what the show's about. But yeah, I think I always loved books. I loved stories. I always just love stories, whether even like as a kid, I remember listening to stuff on the radio, or getting, not even like parents, but other like anyone who would, to like read to me. I just loved stories. I loved hearing about people, and epic tales are really like ordinary tales. And then I think stuff like, oh, what's the director, writer called Shane Meadows?
Shane Meadows, yeah. This is England. Yeah.
Stuff like that. I mean, like, wow. Because I think that came out, I wasn't like that young, but I feel like I watched that quite young, and just remember it being like so mind blowing that there was this like real story about like real people, and it was gritty, and it was really had this sense of like positivity and negativity. Like, it was celebrating like both sides of life and like experiences that these people go through, and like highlighting the difficulties of it, and highlighting like how complex people can be.
And it also sort of did it in quite a fun way though as well, so it wasn't all just, I mean, This Is England, is it night, which one is it, is it 88? It's quite depressing, but the rest of them are all quite fun. I mean, that one's quite heavy. I mean, there obviously is fun there, but that is a hard watch as a series, as good as it is.
Yeah,
but they are generally pretty, like, quite good fun.
I haven't rewatched those series. Like, I love them and I'll talk about them quite a lot, but I haven't gone back and rewatched them, because it's like, once was like enough, like that was good, but don't necessarily need to sit through all of it again.
Yeah. Yeah,
no, I think that really good way to write, and he's like the idea of, like you said, it does it in like a really fun, exciting, not exciting, but like does it in like a really fun sort of way. And I think it's so clever when pieces of like storytelling can do that, where it's not just like a comedy, it's not just a drama, because you can't just beat people over the head with like difficult topics. You have to, you know, like get them in with like humor, and it's more close to real life as well, because life is like often like, I find I've been to a fair few funerals, unfortunately, and I always find them to be like so filled with laughter, because when your emotions are like that high, you end up just like laughing at the most ridiculous stuff, and then you end up crying, and then you're laughing again, and it's that sort of life at its most like crucial and focused, is you experience these emotions like so strongly, but on the complete opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, and it's almost like in a heightened sense, and it's all just so that's very true. I think the best art always does that as well. I watched All of Us Strangers last night. I don't know if you've seen the film, the new one with like Andrew Scott and
want to see that.
Oh my god, it did that actually in a lot, you know, it had like those sort of both extreme emotions. There was like a lot of fun and then a lot of, I won't spoil anything, but like it's one of those ones where I've just been like, fucking hell, that's like, you know, like just thinking about it, just sort of weighing on you. And I think it just, it gets that, it captures that perfectly. The sort of other part of this question is about how, where you're from has influenced you as a creative person. And I love asking people this question, because I think I have quite a strong sense of identity. Maybe it's partly this being Scottish and partly, you know, just having a sort of relating a lot to where I grew up and things. But, and I know this is quite a big part of your work from what I've read about you as well, but like, where did you grow up and how has that sort of influenced you as a creative person?
Oh, like massively, for like good and bad reasons. I think it's impacted me in a positive way and also probably in a bit of like a negative way as well. So I grew up in a little town called Ludlow in Shropshire, which is like right on the Welsh border. It's a place of like massive like disparity. On one hand, if you say it to some people, they go, you grew up there. Oh, it's like a really nice sort of area. And like, it's very historic. A lot of like tourists kind of go there. It's very like quaint. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of like very much like on the surface. But then when you live there, you see actually like there's a lot of like rural deprivation there. There is a huge amount of like poverty, and it just like sits like side by side. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write this show, is that people don't really see this sort of side of like rural life. Mm-hmm. Like when it's done in the media, it's like, like it's murder detectives and landed gentry imperial dramas, right? Or like country bumpkins.
Yeah.
There's no like real stories about people. Like, this country was good. Like, that was probably like one of the best things I've seen. But even that is still taking the piss. Although it does have some really beautiful, tender moments in it, they are still like exaggerated, like sort of stereotype characters, even if they are sort of relatable in some ways.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I suppose the version of this, because I have a similar thing with a lot of Scottish work, and I know Scotland's a big place and there's loads of different parts of it, but it tends to be, you get the urban depiction, as you say, like, it's like, you know, police drama detectives, like, oh, it's really urban, like Trainspotting. Or you get like the rural sort of, it's a horror, or there's been a murder on an island, and it's really like, I feel like they're like the two main sort of stereotypical shows or films that get made set up here. And it's like, again, you can represent a more authentic version of that. And I think it's the same across a lot of the UK. And it's interesting, because I had somebody from the West Midlands on the other day, and obviously I know that's more, if I mix them up, no, East Midlands the other day, and where you're from is more West Midlands.
Yeah.
And again, I feel like that as an area isn't represented in art that much, and you don't see those sort of areas on the TV in the same way.
No, I mean, people generally don't even know where they are. Like, you'll say where it is, and people go, no, never heard of it. And you go, and if you're in the south, like, everyone thinks it's the north. If you're in the north, everyone thinks it's the south. And it's almost becomes like, literally, it's like liminal, sitting where it is, being in the middle, but it also sort of liminal in where people like place it. But yeah, I think it's like when I moved away from that town, and then we talk about it, and how little, then suddenly realizing how little people knew about that area, then made me really want to talk about it more, and then start telling like stories about it. And some of them people would relate to, and other ones that they would go like, what do you mean that happens in the countryside? Like, I grew up in London, and these things like didn't happen. And I was like, yeah, you know, like real things happen to people there.
Yeah. And there's a lot of crime and a lot of like, you know, partly maybe boredom as well, but a lot of quite mental things happen, which people would be shocked by. Like,
yeah,
I don't know, a lot of the drug routes tend to be through places in, you know, rural communities as well.
The whole county line stuff that's going on, been going on for like years, is like huge, and like completely takes over like some rural areas, because people think they can go undetected there because it's not London, and there aren't, partly because people's perception is that they don't think that this sort of like crime happens there, but also just because of like, and it goes back to that sort of deprivation and poverty thing, there's just not the like services, both in terms of enforcement and also in terms of like outreach services, there just like is such like a gap in like funding there. And also people don't think it's a problem because they go, oh, but no, it's like, it seems like a really like well-to-do sort of like area. Like, oh, there's like fields and old buildings and
And I suppose that applies to the arts as well, because not only are you not seeing yourself on screen or on stage very often reflected, like I'm assuming you don't have much access to go and join local theatre clubs or, you know, go to the cinema in ways that may be easier for somebody that, say, grew up in a city like London or Glasgow, etc.
Yeah, and you normally have to travel to like a couple of towns over to like go to the one, and everyone, and it's like the one for like the whole area. If you want to go see a show, you have to travel like an hour to go to like the nearest city.
So what was it like for you, that were you around, were you just not really, did you just not have access to that at all, or was it like quite, did you always sort of go out your way to try and be involved in a sort of scene?
There was like youth groups. They were sort of like few and far between. So that's kind of where I got like into acting, like a lot of people do, you know, just doing like AmDram, like drama club sort of thing on like a month or whatever. And so that was there, but then it would get like, the funding would be cut from the venue. So it would disappear for like a year or two. And then it might come back a couple of years later under like a different name. But by that point, you've kind of lost interest and you've done something else. But like, luckily I'd got the kind of, the bug had been like planted.
Yeah.
I kind of then forgot about it for like most of my teenage years. And then I kind of got back into it like later on.
It's a shame that as well. And I imagine at the moment when the cost of living crisis and with everything going on, that must be happening even more, like in terms of services being cut and stuff. And it so many people must fall into like crime or just fall into like sort of bad paths because they don't have access to anything like youth groups or, you know, especially arts and, you know, things like that, that could give them an alternative path.
Yeah. Then again, I say that there is also like a lot of creativity in that boredom.
That's very true.
Every house we went to, like every mate's house as teenagers we go to, there would be like an instrument. Someone would, there'd be like mates trying to start bands, or there'd be like decks, there'd be like turntables. And it was sort of, you wouldn't put on music, everyone would take it in turns to like jump on the decks. And it was almost like the sort of second skill that everyone had, being able to mix. Not well, but there would always be something like, there would always be like that sort of creative input there. I mean, there was like the drug and the crime like alongside it, but there was still that like creativity there that when I moved away and realised that actually not everyone had those
things,
other things to do.
It's like that subculture almost, isn't it? Lots of great stuff come out of it. Like, I totally relate to that, even though I grew up in a town, so it was maybe, there was maybe slightly more going on, but I just remember always playing in sort of local bands and like just being, you know, going to your mates' house, watching films and really escaping into art, and art being that escape. And I think growing up somewhere where there's not a lot happening really does, you know, that's where the arts are so incredible. And I do think most people I meet who I bond with over things like film and TV, it's usually over because they grew up somewhere similar and they, you know, really projected onto this thing.
That's your entertainment. Yeah, that's what you've got. Perhaps like you all rewatch the same thing like 100 times because there's nothing else to do.
Yeah, but completely. And then you quote it in like conversations even 10 years later and stuff.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. And I think it helps me feel better. Sometimes I have that. So I work in TV as a script editor, and sometimes I'm like, oh, is my job like pointless? So what am I actually? And then I remind myself like when I was that age, and well, I mean, everyone watches content all the time now, but like, you know, you remind yourself of when you know, something got you through a hard time. You're like, no, this is important because there might be somebody watching something I've been involved with making and, you know, that's happening for them. So I don't know if you have that. Do you ever question the purpose of what you do? Or
oh, only like every night. Just like hit a nerve there. It's like attacked. Yeah, no, like constantly. It's funny. I'm such like a big advocate for like the importance of, for want of a better word, like the arts, like creativity and how important it is. But then still in like the dark hours when I'm alone, I'm like, yeah, what is the point? Is this actually affecting like anyone? Like, should have like, I know, then you see like an ambulance go by and you're like, wow, why haven't I become like an ambulance driver? Like, look at them like, saving lives on like a daily basis, or become like a, I don't know, all these other jobs that you think that like have more obvious, clear cut ways of helping people. Yeah, but then like similar to you, I'll reflect on my own life and how much it's like helped me. And then also working in, I think since like going back and working in like theatre rather than just doing poetry, which was also like really beneficial and helpful, but I'll find I'll have like less conversations, whereas in theatre, when you're working with a team, like you end up having more chats and just being in like a room with like, there'll be like technicians, stage managers, director, producer, and realizing that actually there's, it really highlights how many different ways there are into it and how everyone is still like benefited from it and how helpful it's been to so many people, even if it's not directly in there. Oh, I'm a writer. Oh, I'm on stage, or I'm in front of a camera. And you realize like how huge the range is and how much it means to so many people.
And even have an impact on two or three people is bigger than you might than people think as well, because they then you know, if they improve themselves or they take something away, then they go and influence someone else, and it's like that domino effect.
Yeah. So like poets I've seen who've then inspired me to write something, and then I know someone who's been inspired to write something that they've heard me talk about, and I know for a fact that they said, oh, like, think of one poet in particular who they're like, oh my god, I heard your piece and it really inspired me to write this, and then they came back to me like, someone said the exact same thing to me as I said to you, and I remember saying it to another poet, and it's just this like chain effect, like going out into the world of like, yeah, just sort of inspiring each other and helping each other and just reaching out to each other.
I think having that, just reminding yourself that's really important though, and you know, again, why I love doing this podcast all the time, because you speak to so many like-minded people and you're like, okay, we're on the same boat, we all get it. Yeah, another thing I wanted to ask about, and this kind of does tie into where you're from, and I'm looking forward to your answer since you are, you know, a poet and stuff as well, but like, do you have a favorite word or phrase from where you're from?
Ah, yes. But like so many, there's like, it's where I'm from's got such its own like set of words, like almost like its own dialect of like stuff growing up that you say out loud now and you're like, that's like either like really cringy or like terrible. I think one word we used to use like loads growing up and I haven't heard it anywhere else was the word yoy.
Yoy.
Yoy. It would just mean like hello. It would mean like, oh, that's amazing. It would mean goodbye. It could mean like sorry. It could just mean like so many different words. Yeah, yoy. That was I haven't thought about that word in ages actually.
I love it when I hear a word I've not heard before on this, because often you hear a word, you're like, oh, we have that in Scotland. You know what I mean? It's like, I like it when it's a word like that, where I'm like, I've never heard that. That's great. That's a good one.
I also think like growing up where I did, there was quite a lot of creativity in language, but on like a very sort of like level that no one would really realize that they're being creative with language. But there was like, there were so many invented words that I've only heard in like that town, which I won't repeat now because they sound really like cringy if I say them out loud now. But like, is it in the same way of like kids can be creative when they're like making life horrible for each other, you know, the creativity of like school kids when they insult each other and you go like, that's horrible, but also like, that's really creative, like how did you come up
with it?
It's like you think your minds are just like going and you're not being stimulated, so it like that creativity will find its way out, even if it's when it's misdirected, that will turn into like creative ways to insult each other. Or even like not necessarily like buddies amongst like friends, like insulting each other. Like,
yeah. No, it's so true. I mean, I've got this friends I grew up with who I love dearly. Like the way that we still speak to each other now. I mean, we would never speak like that to most people in our life, but like we still do that. And it's like, I actually love it in a way, because it's like some of the insults or some of the in jokes and the lore of it, they're so specific and so creative in a way that you're like, you don't even realize at the time, you're like, that's actually really funny, but like it would only be funny to us five people, etc. But it almost is like a stand-up level of humor sometimes. Maybe it's not that funny, but to us, it, you know, it does seem really creative. And you're right, it's like that way of like using language in such a specific way so quickly as well.
Yeah, that you like really have to be like, every time I go back home, I'm like, I have to like step up my game, like I have to like get so much fast, because it's like you just said, like there's like a law to it, and there is, you've been building it up since like you were like 13 or whatever, or even before that, building up this sort of like frame of references and like, yeah, this whole like law of it.
No, it's magical though, and again, why I love seeing it on screen, like it's so, I think it's so many people can relate to though, it is so universal, it's obviously so specific to each individual friendships and stuff, but I think it is a universal thing, especially among like, I'd say guys in particular, like the way that, not to generalize, I'm sure that happens in other groups as well, but I do think between like male friendships particularly do really have that sort of creative thing.
I think particularly if there's that sort of need to like boast and showboat sort of way, it's that sort of like one-upping each other like constantly, and that's something we kind of bring into the show a bit, particularly in like the beginning, in like the more light-hearted parts, is these two friends telling a story and they're always trying to one-up each other and like take it in turns to jump in on the other person and be like, no, now it's my turn for the attention.
I mean, it's a good and bad thing, but it's realistic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we'll talk about the show in a second, because I'm really interested to get into that. The other part, this is a bit of a cheeky one, I'm adding on to this question, but as you are a sort of poet and you've done a lot of spoken word and things in the past, do you have a favourite word or turn of phrase that you've written yourself that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, favourite word or turn of phrase for myself. Do you know what? It changes. Like every now and again, we sort of chat with another person and be like, I actually quite like that line, but no, I can't think of one right now. There's one from the show where I'm talking about the pub. And I think one of the lines, I hadn't actually thought about this, but then someone the other day after the show was like, I love that line. And that was, there's no queue for the loo, but there's always a line.
Very, very, very good.
There's little bits of wordplay.
I love stuff like that. I know, that's really, really interesting. I listened to your poem on YouTube this morning, The Booze Blues. Really interesting. Was that going back a while, is it?
Yeah. I sort of forgot that one.
It was one of the only ones I could find, because I wanted to sort of, I like to, you know, just, if I can, if you heard the person I'm chatting to his work. And no, I enjoyed it. It was interesting. There was lots of similar sort of plays on words and things.
Yeah, God, yeah, I haven't done. It's funny because like for ages, for a while, like that was one of my main poems. And then you kind of like you write something new and you go, oh no, that was terrible. And you kind of like forget about it. So I might have to go back and like try and remember what some of the words in that were actually.
Yeah, I'll put a link to it underneath the podcast. If anyone's listening right now, they can check it out.
This morning, I woke up. In fact, I woke up in a warm bed, so by all accounts, I should count myself a lucky man, and I do. But this morning, the safe haven's been invaded. The taste of last night's escape and contemplation squat in my mouth on a squalid carpet of stale beer and ash. Up here, through unflushed toilets. In my skull stirs a gas-filled oven preheated to 280 degrees of kamikaze, unable to tell if my mattress is trying to swallow me or vomit me out. Chewing on the gristle of mistakes I made 5 years ago. On sinister premonitions of things that haven't happened yet.
But let's talk about the show, The Land of Lost Content. And I keep going to say content, and I think we all just have content on the mind. You were saying off air that that's been quite a common misconception.
If I could go back and change the title, I would in a heartbeat. Like, not one person has ever like pronounced it right the way I thought of it. And like looking back at it, I go like, of course, because the word content is so much more in like our dialect because of social media and stuff. We like hear the word content all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah. It's one of those things that because the project's been going on for a few years now. When I first thought of it, I was like, yeah, that's it's because it's like taken from this other poem. And I was like, yeah, that's like it's like an in joke that I know about. And it's like really deep and blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, yeah, no, I just wish I called it something like short and snappy.
It is interesting that the word content is just so like in the zeitgeist, like everyone's just, it's just everywhere, isn't it? Like content. I mean, ironically, technically, you could argue this is content as well. It's just like content everywhere. But of course, in this context, the land of lost content.
So yes.
tell us all about it.
So it's kind of feeding into what we've already been talking about. It's autobiographical, all the names and events have been kind of moved around and changed. But it's just about growing up in a small town, and it's kind of told through one friend, my character, who also called Henry, from a lack of imagination, coming back to the pub and sort of having to face up to everything that he's sort of left behind when he's meeting up with this other friend. And it's kind of ambiguous whether the other friend is there or not, or if he's sort of like dealing with his like memories. And then as these two friends like sit in a pub and chat, they sort of see other characters around, and that sort of like then triggers like other memories about their time growing up. And it takes you through the full spectrum of the messiness of adolescence. It kind of goes in terms of it. I don't know why I'm doing this because no one will be able to...
But like, waving
my hand up and down. It's of this ebb and flow of you're making your mark in the world and you're going out and you're thinking, you're like, yes, come on, like we can do this. Like the world is ours. We can, there's like so many opportunities. We can like do what we want and everything's going to be like the way we've been told it would on films and all these coming of age stories that we see in like films and TV, and then just life not living up to those expectations. And then the sort of the deflatedness of that, which is where a lot of the comedy comes from in the show. It's also where a lot of like the heartache comes from, of just kind of realizing that life isn't what you thought it was going to be as a kid and having to come to terms with that. And when like reality kicks in and you get a bit older and like the harsher sides of life come out, and those like fun, carefree decisions you make as when you're younger sort of coming back to haunt you later on. So it starts off very high paced and very like fast paced, a lot of energy. And then by the end of it, it gets quite, still got the energy to it, but it gets sort of a bit more like hard hitting.
Yeah, and how much is like music and things used in this as well? Is there quite a lot of influence from that?
There's a lot of, it's funny, like the music that's in the show is not the music I would have been listening to at that age, but we use music more as like to trigger different years or like like nostalgia in the audience. So there's like a scene that's set in like a year 7 school disco, and it's like where the friends sort of like meet for the first time. And like the person who did, Tida, who did our sound design, did this really amazing like distorted like mashup of like 2000 songs of like Apple Bottom Jeans and stuff like that, but like really like slow and like weird and like hazy and like memory and dream like. And there's like another scene where we talk about like Apologize by Timbaland and One Republic holding the number one spot for 10 weeks. School kids play off their Sony Ericssons every day during morning tutor like
Tinnitus. Oh my god. That song, man, I've not heard
like,
of that.
Oh, those songs, they just come back, and even if they're not songs you particularly liked, but like they're just everywhere. Yeah.
It hit me when there's some nostalgia even mentioning that song. I've not thought about that song in a long, long time.
Yeah,
I'll be getting listened to as soon as this interview is done, by the way. Just for the No, it's interesting. And like, you guys are obviously on tour with this at the moment. How's that all been going? And like, you know, do you want to plug some dates? I mean, it'll be linked underneath anyway for anyone that wants to find out
Yes,
more.
please. We've got loads of dates. I think the best way to check them out is to go on my website, which is henrymad2ds.com, or check out my Instagram, which is at henrymadpoet. Put some links in. But yeah, we've got Oxford's coming up this week, then Bristol, which is really exciting because that's sort of closer to my neck of the woods. It's been amazing. But also, as this podcast is about like demystifying the industry a bit, I've got to be honest, it's so much more work than I thought it would. Than I thought it would be. Like, we've only just like scratched the surface, and I'm like absolutely knackered. I keep like, I've become like addicted to these like ginger shots in a bottle, which I now can't stop drinking.
They are quite good. So like, I used to have them all the time on the train. I used to. They're so expensive, but they're worth it.
Oh yeah, I've like, it's like my tour treat. Like, cause we're all like, got to keep things on budget, and then like my little decadence is these like ginger shots.
You went for value for money though, because you went for the bigger bottle. So
oh yeah, I've moved on. I've moved on from the little bottle. The more it's a slippery slope. But yeah, it's like I can't do anything else. I love it so much, but it is so tiring, and there's so much to it. Of like, you know, we're like a small team, so it's packing the setup in the car, arriving to a venue, packing down, either driving back late or staying overnight, being in like new places quite regularly, and also like the emotional impact of the show. It's like really, it's really personal, and it's dealing with like a lot of like difficult memories, which I'm okay with talking about. I wasn't gonna make the show, but it still like requires you to sort of like go to those places. But yeah, it's good. I do love it. But
no, I appreciate you sort of being honest about that, and as you say, like going into the realities, because obviously if people just see your Instagram posts about, you know, the great show tonight, but you just see the good part. And I think the problem with the way that sort of society functions at the moment, we're all seeing everyone's best days. We've never seen everyone's worst days. And, you know, I think it's useful for people to understand that it's not all like perfect. You know, there will be those long drives and those moments of, you know, emotional intensity and things as well. Do you struggle to be present when you come off stage? This is something I like to ask people, because it's not quite the same because I'm not in character, but whenever I do live podcasts, which I've done quite a few of and done them at the Fringe and stuff as well, I really struggle coming off stage to like take any of it in. I feel quite drained, even if it was a really good show. It's like, I don't know, like disassociating almost, or just struggle to be there.
Yeah. It will sort of hit me like an hour later. Then I'm just sort of can't really remember what just happened like on stage. I think that's like quite a common one. You come off and you go like, I've got no idea what just happened. Or you come away with a good or a bad feeling. But yeah, I think because we have to like, we've got quite like a messy set. It's a really simple set and it looks really cool, but it's like an absolute faff to clean. So we kind of get off stage, wait like 30 seconds, and then we kind of have to like get back on. And I think actually that sort of like process is quite good for sort of keeping you grounded, because it doesn't let you like dwell and reflect too much. You're like, okay, we've got to get out and we've like covered this theatre with like bits of fluff, in which we have to like pack up into bin bags really quickly. But yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about.
And I suppose the other part of this question and sort of talking about the demystifying it all is like, how did you go about getting this show from like, you know, an early draft to like where it is now, going on a tour and stuff? What's the pathway there for people listening?
So find someone who's more experienced to hold your hand and help you do it. I had sort of given up on the show. It used to be like a one-person show, and I just kept hitting my head over the wall with like, couldn't figure out how to write an Arts Council application, had no contact in theatre, had no idea how you went about things. And I was kind of trying to do it for about 2 years by myself. And I did it like a couple of times sort of locally. I did like one evening at the Brighton Fringe, which like four people came to. I did it then a couple of times in Margate, once at the Tom Thumb, and then once at Albies for Making Waves Festival. And only did that last one because I think they were offering like £200 for it, and I was skint, and I was like, oh, brilliant, I'm going to submit my show and see if I can get £200. And then Nick Connaughton from Pleasance like happened to be coming to see it, sort of doing, sort of scouting out the festival, because there was like a few shows on, and he came to see it and he just took me aside afterwards and was basically like, this is good, like your writing is good, it's like really relatable. Like, he's from Australia and he was like, I could relate to these characters and I'm not from this country, like you've really like got the essence of something really important here, but it's not great. Like, it could be better, and like, let me help you make it better. And then that's when it became like a two-person show, which I never would have thought about doing, because I didn't know how to find another actor. I knew how to find me. And he's like, no, it's fine, like there is a process, we contact people, blah 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 blah, I'll help you with the application. And then he really sort of like came on board as a director / producer, and also as like a mentor. And if it wasn't for that, like I wouldn't be doing the show like now. Maybe that would have been a good thing, though. Maybe I would have become an ambulance driver and be out saving lives.
I think that's a really interesting sort of journey into it beginning. And obviously, you did this at the Fringe in 2022 as well, didn't you? That was like the first big sort of part of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, I loved the Fringe. It felt like coming home. Exhausting. It like took me about a month to recover from it, but It was, yeah, incredible. And I think it's the first time that I really felt recognized as like a professional. Like people were coming to see it who like weren't just friends and stuff. And people, I was talking to other writers and they're like, oh, do you have an agent and stuff like this? And I was like, oh, but like, I didn't even know, didn't even think about that as like an option. And yeah, that was like the first time I felt like I was getting the work seen on like a sort of like on a wider scale on like a national level. And it was because of that they were able to book the tour then.
But the reviews were great from the Fringe. Like you were like in like top 10 lists and things, so clearly like resonated as well.
Yeah, it's funny, the show is really resonated with so many people, and every now and again like someone will come to see it and be like, didn't get it, but that's theater. It's really funny when that happens because you kind of get used to like people being like, oh yeah, yeah, really related to it, and then you'll get like a review online or like from a critic who's like, I don't get it. Like, that wasn't, like, I don't get what they're talking about. And then I always find that really interesting. But yeah, yeah, in Edinburgh, like, largely the reviews were, like, really supportive. And it was like, oh, I'm talking about this tiny little town where I grew up, and it's the stories of me and my silly little friends, like, making a mess of everything and sort of failing constantly. And people are, like, wanting to see it. And they've been like, oh, my God, that's, like, that was my experience too. And be like, oh. And going back to what you were saying earlier about when you question about whether, why are we doing this? That was one of those reasons where you go, this is why we're doing it, because you're reaching out to people you don't know and like managing to connect with them.
How do you find the sort of negative reviews though? Because I sometimes find one negative thing could outweigh like 10 positive things, which is so irritating. It's the way our brains work, but it's hard.
Yeah, I'm learning to get better at it, but probably quite vain and egotistical in that sense that when I see something bad, I'm like, just focus on the bad thing and get upset by it. But learning not to dwell too much. And it's funny because if other people get a bad review or something, it's so easy to give the advice of like, oh, don't listen to that. Oh, it's like stupid. What do they know? It's just one person's opinion. And then they say it's about you and you go, even if you had like someone like the day before from somewhere more prestigious saying something like much nicer and kinder. And you go, but what about that one person who said the mean thing?
The thing is as well, though, like, and I know logically we all know this when you get a negative thing or a negative review, but it works not really for everyone anyway. There'll be people that come from totally different backgrounds that just aren't going to get it, and you don't really care.
Yeah, 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 it's absolutely fine. And like, it just doesn't have to be that personal. Like, I'll go to see stuff quite regularly, which I'm not a huge fan of, but I'm like, oh, I'm still glad I went to see it. Like, it wasn't for me, blah, 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 blah. But yeah.
I'm also interested to sort of ask about influences on your work, not just for this show, but like wider. And there was a quote, I love that, you know, usually when I do research, I don't write down this many quotes. So I generally mean this as a compliment. There was some good stuff in the interviews, but you said something about how you liked ordinary-isizing the extraordinary.
Yeah, I don't know if that is a real word or if I've made it up, but ordinary-izing.
I like it. It should be a real word. Oh, it's really cool. It's just my dyslexic brain struggling to... That's me thinking I'm surely saying this wrong, but because that's how I question everyone. But no, I just thought it was such an interesting way to look at it. I don't know. I think all the films and TV shows I love are doing that. So I just thought it was, I've always loved the ordinary and work and stuff. So I just thought it was a really interesting quote.
I think it's what like the stories always appeal to me, like we're talking about, like This Is England and stuff. It's that like just, it's just stories of humans, pretty unspectacular in many ways, but also spectacular in others.
And what are the sort of bigger influences on your work?
I think a lot of stuff is just kind of not necessarily like big things. It'd be like my friend's shows that I'll go and see, like one person shows. On the flip side of that, it'll be stuff like Jez Butterworth. Like I remember going to see I saw like a student production of Jerusalem, and after it had stopped being on theater in the theaters like the first time around, and was just like, and then went and read it and was like, this is the first time I've found it so relatable, and was like, this is like the first time I've seen my life growing up like actually like represented in a like in a piece of art, like, but it's been done like really authentically. And then like, it's funny, I love like modern, like contemporary poets. I also love the classical poets. I love the romantic sensibilities of the romantic poets. So it sounds really dumb to say. You know, I love that all the stuff like stuff really like over the top and just being like, yes, why can't life be like this? Like juicy and just pushed to the extremes and devastating and amazing. But yeah.
No, it's interesting. And I suppose the other question I've sort of asked you about the pathway for the show, and I know that's kind of more in the theatre world, but like as a poet as well, like what are the sort of pathways for anyone wanting to get into that? Because that's such a, it's more, maybe more of a tricky one because it's slightly more niche. And I think, unfortunately, the connotation of poetry, a lot of people just think of boring poems at school and not this sort of spoken word, quite cool, interesting stuff that is going on across the country.
And then even spoken word's got quite a bad reputation. I think it's like 21 Jump Street, or was it 22 Jump Street, did it no favours, where they were like Jonah Hill doing the like Cynthia slam poet. And it's just, as soon as you say, oh, do you like slam poetry, that's all people will quote. But what I do love about poetry is the immediacy of it. Like, I love theatre, but this show I've been working on, like, trying to get it on a tour for like 4 or 5 years. Poetry, it's like you can finish writing a poem in your bedroom that day and then just go to an open mic and you're performing it on stage and you're getting live feedback, and it feels really like current. You can like respond to things so fast. And also it's like a really lovely community if anyone is wanting to get into it. It's, I think anything seems scary when you're starting out, but the poetry community is just so friendly. Like, it's just a bunch of weird poet nerds who are just really excited by anyone else who wants to get involved. And you see such like an amazing like cross-section of people. It really is for like everyone from like all different backgrounds in terms of like sexuality, gender, like race, class as well. And there's just sort of, yeah, there's not many other forms of art where I'll see such like a mixed audience at the same event. And that's what I like, love about it. And everyone's just so friendly. So yeah, if you are wanting to get into it, write a poem. It doesn't have to be good. Just get up there and like share it.
I think it's the same for lots of things though. It's like even writing plays and stuff, it doesn't have to be good straight away, because, you know, as you said, when the person discovered you, they said like, oh, you know, it could be better.
Yeah.
And I think being open to that is really helpful, because everything can always be better and continually improve.
Yeah. And just also like realizing that it's like a constant journey. I think there's like a really good quote by Leonard Cohen, which I can't remember properly, but talking about how he was always uncomfortable being called a poet because he hadn't felt he'd earned it. And he was like, it's a constant journey to become a poet. And that's like one of the greatest sort of like writers of his generation.
Is
like,
I suppose that speaks to what we were saying earlier about this sort of imposter syndrome, that even when you go higher, you know, higher up, it's like, man, that's crazy. Even Leonard Cohen doesn't think he's good enough.
Yeah.
We're all screwed.
Yeah, right.
I know we've been speaking for nearly an hour, so I sort of started to wrap things up. But another question I wanted to ask about, and I know mental health, again, is a massive theme of the show that you're doing at the moment, but how do you sort of protect your mental health in this sort of crazy career that you're sort of doing and in this sort of quite fast-paced industry? And I know mental health is such a broad term as well. I mean, I kind of prefer, which is a Simon Sinek way of talking about it, but I think he calls it mental fitness. I kind of prefer that term as well. It's interesting.
I think that's good, because it allows it to be something that you can train, whereas it always feels like something that happens to you, whereas mental fitness is something you can work at. And I think that's like such an important part of it. It's hard, because I don't think I'd always look after my mental health as well as I should. Like, there was like my sort of stock answer would be like, oh, I'll try to occasionally do a bit of exercise now and again, or like try to eat healthy, and we'll try to do those things. More and more I'm finding it's like carving out time for myself and not doing anything particularly with that time, but just like just time to be alone. Like, not even like, I always want to be out. I would love being social, love hanging out with people, you know, get me down the pub any day of the week, just to like be around stuff happening. And I've found that I've needed to sort of take a step back from that and just be like, oh, actually it's okay to like just sit quietly sometimes and just like let yourself rest. So I think that's the thing I'm doing most at the moment, is like learning to sort of say no to things and actually just take some time to be quiet.
It's hard though. I totally relate to you on that. Like, I'm the same. I love to be busy, and because I sort of, my job at the moment is Monday to Friday, like when it comes to the weekend, I just want to, you feel like I've got to cram everything into those 2 days, and it's like sometimes you do just need a day to like not do much and not even be watching stuff, because even like you could still be like, oh, I need to do this, and it just generally trying to do very little. And yeah, it's hard, it's not easy.
You do work in like, I think with like loads of jobs, but I think creative sectors as well, like it's so easy to be like checking emails even on like a day off, and it's so like, or like late at night or like first thing in the morning before you even really meant to be working. It's like really hard to like properly switch off.
Yeah, completely. Especially if you're doing more than one thing and you have more than one project. You know, I'm obviously running the podcast on top of work as well. So it's like that ends up eating into a lot of evenings and weekends as well. And it's a really hard process. I'm sure that most people listening are in the same boat, but I think you're right. Like, it is, you know, it's having those quiet times when you can, and everyone's different, and obviously this isn't a prescriptive answer, it's just your own experiences. But again, I appreciate you answering that honestly, because I think the more people demystify these sort of things, it's really helpful. Just get a real job. Obviously the name of the podcast is Just Get a Real Job. We'd all had to work jobs we hated to support ourselves along the journey, but what's your most sort of memorable job or worst part-time job you'd ever had?
Ooh, probably like doing probably pot wash. I've like did a bit like cape in, and like that was like, I've done like hospitality work my entire life and I love it, and like I'll always go back to it just like whenever I need some extra money. But yeah, I think pot wash was like, I think it's because I didn't have an audience, whereas like, I like front of house stuff because it's like really chatty and social. But I just remember just being like back in this like dark kitchen, being like drowning in like dirty plates and just being like, got no one to talk to. That was probably like one of my least favorite. But I've generally been quite good with jobs, I think, because I like, so many people get like bar or restaurant jobs as a sideline. I think the fact that I just naturally like really gravitated towards that kind of work anyway has been really helpful.
Do you like the social aspect of it the most? Is that what?
Yeah. Actually, the other day I had to pretend to be a pirate in Chatham for like 3 hours. That was pretty soul destroying. Actually, now I think about it, that was quite bad. Sometimes it's the creative jobs which are actually the ones which are close to what you want to be doing, but aren't quite what you want to be doing. Like, yeah, I'm getting paid to perform all day. I'm also walking around with like a stuffed parrot on my arm, doing a really bad pirate voice, being like, oh, this is terrible. It's actually bad as well, it's worse things to be doing.
Oh man, you have to put yourself through stuff sometimes, I guess. Yeah, it's all I've material. It's all material for future poems and plays. It's worth it. Well, just sort of to close out, I usually ask people to give their sort of, you know, closing advice to anyone that wants to get into what they're doing, but I'm going to sort of ask two questions here. I also want you to tell me what your advice would be for yourself maybe 10 years ago, as well as your closing advice for anyone wanting to get into what you do. They might be the same answer.
Work harder, be more focused. I think I was sort of naturally quite lazy, and I was just sort of thought things would happen, and then realizing that actually, like, no, if you care about it, you make the time. Don't watch the refs. Like, I'll be probably quite tough on myself, which is not the same advice I'd give to someone else. Like, the advice I'd give to myself is like, get off the sofa and stop working. Like, you could have made things happen a lot faster than you have. My advice to other people would be like, don't be so harsh on yourself.
Sound a hint of irony there.
Yeah. Also, I think it's having, like, it's kind of coming back to what we're talking about at the beginning of, like, there's not necessarily one route into it. Do lots of things, like, be and have interests. Like, be into, if you're into theatre, also make time to be into visual art. If you're into visual arts, make sure you go and see movies, because it all, like, go to gigs, like, they all link into each other. And I was thinking, after you asked the question earlier about what influences are, and actually I think I was trying to think of like poets and theatre makers, but actually I think a lot of it is music, and like the storytelling in music and the storytelling in like visual art and stuff like sculpture. So yeah, I'd say it might not be the most practically helpful, but I think as like nurturing yourself as like an emerging and upcoming artist, like having lots of different passions and interests, like, really shows.
And just a sort of cheeky bonus question to close on, but like, what's the sort of last piece of art in any form that you connected with that you can remember?
Oh, that's a good one. I actually saw, this is like, again, a theatre show, but I saw Wish You Weren't Here by Katie Redford at Soho Theatre in London the other day. And that was, I kind of went because I'd heard like some good things, even though the synopsis wasn't necessarily like a show that I would typically go and see. And then I ended up seeing it and being like, oh wow, that actually really, really hit me way more than I thought it would. Yeah. So that was a really good piece.
I think sometimes that's the way, though. Eh? You think you can judge stuff. Like, I had sometimes a podcast guest, like, I'll get sent from a PR agent, say sometimes use like a podcast guest. I'm like, oh, I don't know if they'll be that interested to speak to them. And then some of the best conversations you ever end up having. And then sometimes it's when someone you think they're going to be incredible. It's the opposite. I think you never judge something, including shows. Henry, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. I've loved this conversation. You've made it very easy for me, but thank you very much for your time on a Monday. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much for having me. This is good. I sort of feel like I could like talk for like another hour now. I'm like, right, let's get into it. My brain feels like it's finally kicking into gear.
It's a bit of free therapy for you. There you go.
Cheers.
No, I hope everyone goes and sees the show as well on its tour, and links to that in the show notes.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely chatting to you.
Well, there you go. That was episode 133 of Just Get a Real Job. Thank you again to Henry for chatting to me. As you can tell from listening, he's much more articulate than I am, but I really, really enjoyed chatting to him. Some really, really interesting stuff there. And as always, really appreciate him being so open and honest about his experiences as well. Be sure to go and check out The Land of Lost Content. I keep going to go and say content like we talked about in the show as well. It's just ingrained in my head. But be sure to go and check out that if it's on tour anywhere near you. There's links to all the dates of that in the show notes as well. And be sure to go and check out Henry's work. As always as well, if you enjoyed this week's episode of the podcast, be sure to post about it on social media. Be sure to share it far and wide. Leave us a little 5-star review. And if you even want, drop us a message. Our email's on our website. And you can follow us as well on Instagram at Just Get a Real Job, or on X at Just Get a Real Job as well. We also have a Patreon. All the money we make goes back into the upkeep of the podcast. And yes, thank you as always for listening. As always, a massive thank you to Amy Dinsdale, who does the artwork for this podcast, and to Elliot Mitchell for doing a great job of editing this podcast, as always. Enjoy the rest of your week, everyone, and we'll be back again next week for another episode of Just Get a Real Job. Just get a real job.